Good to be with you today. It became evident to me when I stepped in the building this morning that I seem to owe you an explanation, at least, maybe an apology, but at least an explanation. I stepped in the building and David Landis said he was peeved with me and told me why. It's in regard to a car wreck that my son-in-law had on the same day that I was over here the last time. So I'll tell you what happened and you can decide whether I owe you an explanation or something more. But just before we came over here last month on whatever day that was, on the Sunday, I got a phone call and it was my daughter informing me that my son-in-law, John Morris, who many of you know, he's been over here, and there are two oldest children that are still at home. The names would be Peter and Zion, teenage young people. They had been on I-70 on their way up to Fayette for some work that John was going to do that day and had an accident out on I-70. She said they were hit from behind and their car went into the guardrail and turned over and they had been taken to the hospital in Warrensburg, and she didn't know how serious it was. She didn't know that it was serious or that it wasn't. She knew that Peter, the young man, had a cut on his head and was getting about six staples. They're not stitches anymore. They're staples. And they don't shave it anymore. They just glue it, I guess, and put the staples in. Much different than used to be. Anyway, she knew that and that there were some at least minor injuries. And I said, well, what do you need me to do? You want me to just drop everything and go? Or she said, under the circumstances, I told her we were about ready to leave for Gregory. And under the circumstances, it probably would be best to just wait until later and keep in touch. So that's what I did. I got in the car to bring my wife over here. And she said, who was that on the phone? I said, I'll tell you later. And the reason I did that is because I didn't know anything. I'd say it's partly personality, if you need an explanation. My son-in-law calls me a fact finder. It's hard for me to know what to do next until I have the facts, so I seek out the facts first. He said, not everybody's like that, but you're like that. Anyway, I just told my wife, I'll tell you later. And I did that because I didn't want her to be sitting here crying over possibly nothing. While we were going through the services with you all, I really didn't want to back out of coming over here because I don't like to make life any more difficult for my elders than it has to be. Bill had just had knee surgery, and I thought, you know, if I can possibly go to Gregory, I need to do that. So I just came on over here, and I didn't really have anything to tell you, except I could have said that they had had an accident, but I didn't know anything about it. So that's the bottom line. Now, maybe I should tell you further what I found out further. I did make some phone calls while I was here that day and learned that at some point that they were coming home from the hospital, so it must not have been as bad as it might have been. Anyway, I know a little more now, so I guess I should just explain a little more possibly. They had been going on I-70. You may remember that was a kind of a foggy morning. So he wasn't even going the speed limit on I-70. I think he said he was going about 65. The speed limit is 70. They were by the Concordia exit. And the children said, John himself doesn't even remember this, but the children said that he looked in his rearview mirror and said, oh my goodness. And then he said, oh no. But they didn't know. Maybe they had started to turn around to see what he was talking about, but suddenly they got hit in the rear, not completely in the center of the rear, but off to the side a little bit, and then along the side of the car. So it caused the car to veer over onto the shoulder and then into the guardrail, and that's why it turned completely over and then just slid along the shoulder of the road for some distance. So when everything stopped, they're hanging there upside down in their seatbelts. All of them have hit their heads on the ceiling and sort of bounced around inside the car. They don't know what's happened. It's happened so fast. So they ask each other, is everybody okay? And the answer is, well, I don't know. And then the next question was, can anybody get their door open? Because three of the doors would not open, but one would. So they all went out that door. The the young man who had hit them stopped. Apparently, he was going really fast. Somebody said maybe even 100 miles an hour. He was on his way to work. And the idea was that he had gone to sleep, which is hard for me to get because he was veering over to not hit them. So I don't know. Texting occurred to me, but I don't. That's just my thought. Maybe texting his boss that he was going to be late to work. I don't know. Texting is a real issue on the roads now. Anyway, they were upside down. The car was totaled. The highway patrol came, gave the young man that hit them a ticket. And they were taken to an ambulance to the hospital. So Peter had that head injury that I mentioned to you. All of them have had some, but John felt like maybe he had a concussion. There's really nothing you can do about that, I guess, except just let it go away. And he was in a little bit of a malaise for a while, he said. And Zion has had some neck pain and back pain, so those kinks are all being worked out even yet. They don't really know for sure. But we're thankful to God. We're thankful for airbags. They're all deployed and possibly saved them from extra damage. And we're just thankful that it wasn't any more serious than it was. So that's what I know now. But at the time that I was with you last month, I just didn't really know anything. So I wouldn't have known what to say to you. But if I should apologize, I want to apologize. I just didn't know what to say. I didn't even want to say anything to my wife until we were in a position to find out more. So the minute we left here, I said, have you got your phone? Is it on? We need to call Amber. And I started explaining the situation to her. So we went right out to their house. They were all home by then. And then I took, since it's full explanation, sorry, I took then Lynn and Peter and Zion and Amber back to the site of the crash so that we could recover the things that had flown out of their car because windows were blown out and found right beside I-70. I found John's mileage book that he needs for his taxes. We found, I think, a Bible laying there beside the road. And we got everything we could from beside the road. Then we went over to where the car had been taken in Concordia and cleaned everything out of the car to the extent that we could get into the nooks and crannies of the car. I had to go to the neighbors and borrow a steel bar to even get the trunk open because it was really a destroyed car. So when I saw the car, I was doubly grateful that everybody was okay because just to look at the car and say your family was in an accident in this car, you could think, well, they surely didn't survive that. So we just felt very blessed that it wasn't any worse than it was. So I apologize if I have, David said he was a little peeved with me, and maybe I figured if he was, maybe some of the rest of you were. I just didn't know what to say because I didn't feel like I knew anything. So I guess it's just a personality issue. David said, you're not very forthcoming about your family. And that's probably true. When Lynn was in rehab, I think it bothered kind of you that I didn't say more about it when she was in rehab for her knee surgeries. But she didn't really want me to say anything about it, and there really wasn't that much to say. I mean, it's just better every day. I think I said that, and that was true. But I don't know. It's just a personal tendency, so I'm sorry if it was a problem for anyone. And we can all praise God together that things weren't any worse. I think they're pretty much back to normal now, maybe a few lingering symptoms, but much, much better than it might have been. So I'm sorry if I should be. I still don't know if I should be, but I do love David's thought was, well, you put us in a position where we couldn't pray for them. And we love your family, he said. And I understand that, and I deeply appreciate that. So I'll try to be a little more open about that type of thing in the future. But I'm not saying I'll succeed, but I'll try to be. All right, so I hope that covers that, and I hope we can all feel good that it wasn't any worse than it was. I'm sure we can. Now, the second thing I need to say to you comes from also when I was here last time, Sherry Lancaster C. had a note at the top portion of a page of her Bible where it had been blank. She had written in there something about a cow and a pig and a chicken and a mouse. And for the life of her, she couldn't figure why she had written that, but she had my name connected to it. A cow and a pig and a chicken and a mouse. And it was so baffling to her that she took me aside. She showed me the note. And it turned out this was from a speech I made here probably less than 3 years ago, but lots of things run through our brains and it's hard to remember. So I told her that the next time I was here, I would try to repeat some of the things that I had said on that day and put those animals in context. So I want to do that today. You know, that I'll just say a word about this too, since I'm talking about myself today, our family. I used to be very, very leery of repeating anything that I had already said to you in the church. I felt like it should be something different every time. But after a few decades, that gets more difficult to do because on certain subjects, you've already put it as well as you thought you could. And if you change it very much, you're going to wind up with something you feel like is inferior to the other way of saying it. So I do repeat things to you sometimes now, but I usually try to make it a repetition of something that's been said to you by me at least like 10 or 20, 30 years ago, not something that was said 3 years ago. So I'm altering that today. I got paranoid on that. I'll just tell you this, since this is talking about my family. I got paranoid on that as a young speaker when we were up. I remember where we were, but it's not important where it was. Up in North Missouri one day when I think Lynn and I were just newly married, hadn't been married very long. And I spoke, and I came back to my seat on that Sunday morning, and my new wife leans over to me and says, "Haven't you given that here?" Oh, no, have I? So I started keeping better records then, and I try to record in writing where I've given what talks or what ideas, stories at least. But I got a little paranoid about it during the early years. And I didn't realize the value of repetition. Now I think that if something is worth giving once, and by the way, I've given a lot of talks here that turned out to not be worth giving once, and so I never repeated those, I hope, but if something is worth giving once, it's worth giving again, I think. I mean, I enjoy hearing something repeated. I don't, as I said last time when I had Drew talk in the afternoon, it's a treat to me because I hardly ever get to hear anybody else talk, and Drew did such a fine job, Drew Hartman. So next time I'm here when he's here, you may see repetition of that because he had a whole lot of talk notes with him. Anyway, I got paranoid about it, so it's with a little bit of trepidation that I repeat this, but Sherry wanted an explanation of what that was, and I think it's good. I look back over those notes, and I think there's value there, especially in view of the subject. Let me tell you the story. The story about the cow and the pig and the chicken and the mouse. They all lived together in a barn. And one day, the mouse was extremely distraught to find a mouse trap that was all set up in order to catch him. And he didn't know what to do about it. He couldn't think of any way of springing it because a mouse is such a small, weak little creature. He couldn't do anything about this set mouse trap himself. So he asked the chicken, "Could you just take a stick over there and spring that mouse trap for me?" But the chicken said, "Mouse trap? That's got nothing to do with me. What do I care?" And he wouldn't do it. So he said to the pig, "Could you just go over there and stick your little cloven hoof down and spring that mouse trap? I would really appreciate it if you could do it for me because I can't do it for myself." And the pig said, "Well, what's it to me? I don't care about a mouse trap. Why should I help you?" So he went to the cow, and the cow said, "Well, I'm really busy today. Could you come back next week?" The mouse was so dejected that he left the barn and went looking for another place to live. But the next day, a rattlesnake got its tail caught in that mouse trap and was threshing around, trying to get it off, making all kinds of noise. And when the farmer's wife, who was nearby, went over to investigate what all the noise was, she got bitten by the rattlesnake. And she developed a raging fever. And everybody knows that the best way to treat a fever is with chicken soup. So the farmer got his knife and went to the barn for the main ingredient of chicken soup. made her some chicken soup, but unfortunately her condition still continued to deteriorate, and the neighbors gathered in knowing that she wasn't long for this world, and he had to butcher the pig in order to feed all the visitors that they had. Finally, she died, and so many people came to the funeral that the farmer ended up butchering the cow to make dinner for all of them. So the point of the story was that in the end, everybody lost because of a failure to care. And that's what the talk was about. It's a failure to care, which we often call apathy. Sometimes it's just so hard to care. Caring can be dangerous. Caring causes you to open up your heart and leaves you open to hurt. And sometimes when you get hurt, you feel like you just were a fool. Sometimes people have been hurt, and that's why they're afraid to care. You can't die if you're not alive, so just harden yourself so you don't feel any pain. So we keep a secret store of indifference as a sort of a self-protection. Problem with that is, well, there are a number of problems with it, but one of them is that as the people of God, we're supposed to care because Jesus cared. He taught us to care by caring himself. We are to care even if it means a cross. All of human need is a cry for help. And we should answer that cry for our own good. In Christ, none of us are free to live isolated lives. We owe too much to those who have helped us in the past, and we're too closely related to everybody around us to have an attitude like that. The scripture I used was 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 25 and 26, talking about the parts of the body having concern for each other. You just studied this recently with Jack. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. So, Sherry, that's what that story was about. Somebody said the biggest problem in the church is apathy, but who cares? And that really, that one sentence often expresses the way things are. Apathy is unconcern, it's disinterest, it's carelessness, and can even include negligence. It's a sort of a spiritual numbness that can become a paralysis, and its temperature is lukewarm, according to Revelation chapter 3. Apathy itself in English is a compound word. It means without, it means without, and the pathy means feeling. So it's literally without feeling. Apathy doesn't have any passion, doesn't have any enthusiasm. Its bywords are, I don't care, I don't want to be bothered, I don't know, and I don't want to know. A few years ago, and I think I used this example when I talked about this before, there was a man organizing a big rock concert to raise money for starving people in Africa. His name was Bob Geldof. And he said that when he was organizing that, it was called Live Aid show, to feed those starving people, he became adept at countering the objections the musicians had. These musicians were all going to play for free and earn this money, get this money for the starving people. He said, no matter what the objection was, I would always have a way to counter that and get them to come and play. But he said, when I went to ask Keith Richards, by the way, Keith Richards' name has sometimes been Keith Richard and sometimes Keith Richards. He has changed it himself. I guess he doesn't know which way he wants it to be, but you can say it either way. Anyway, guitarist for the Rolling Stones, many of you know who he is. Anyway, when I asked Keith Richards to play, the response was, I don't care about starving people in Africa. And Geldof said, I was speechless because there's no counter to that argument. What do you do when somebody just flatly says, I don't care? There was no way to get him to play. The way he got Keith Richards to play, by the way, was to get somebody else that Richards enjoys playing with to be at the show. And then Keith Richards did come and play with that man. Anyway, it's an expression of how helpless we can feel when somebody just flat doesn't care. There is really not much of an answer to that. You can weakly say, well, you should, and here's why. But not easy to change it when somebody does not care. Here was an interesting experiment. This was done at Princeton Theological Seminary. Most of the people that were going there were religiously oriented in one way or another. And they did an experiment with 40 students. But the students did not know it was an experiment. They thought it was real life. These 40 students were in one building, but they were sent out one at a time on a mission to another building. And in order to get to that other building, they had to pass by, on the way, a victim, a supposed victim, who was seemed to be in serious physical trouble. This victim was slumped in a doorway, had their head down, eyes were closed, they were coughing and moaning in pain and trying to attract the attention of people who were going by. Now, nobody could not know that he was there as he passed by. 40 students went by one, only 16 of them stopped to offer help. He reminds you of what Jesus told about the story of the Good Samaritan. 24 out of 40 religious students passed on by in a hurry, just like the priest and the Levite in Jesus' story. Now, it's easy for us to do that as well. If we pass by on the other side, we seldom refuse to help point blank. We always can rationalize, well, we would help if, well, we will help when. And God knows whether our excuses are valid or not. You and I don't always know, but God knows whether our excuses are valid. He knows which ones of them are not acceptable. And the ones that God knows are not acceptable, we'd better not use anymore. We may have excuses that are all right with man and all right with us, but will they avail with God? At the cleansing of the temple, Jesus drove out the money changers, and he did it with a fiery zeal. He had a personal concern that was filled with patience and love, but at the same time, nobody ever surpassed the Lord in enthusiasm. He went so far as to quote a passage from the Old Testament that said, "The zeal of your house, Father, has eaten me up." It ate him up. Zeal ate him up. The word zeal in the New Testament is used 14 times, and it means to be warm. It means to even boil up with heat. Fervent in spirit in Romans 12:11 is the same original idea. "Awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light." Ephesians 5:14. I referenced Revelation 3. "Because you are lukewarm, and neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth," which is the expression meaning to vomit. Revelation 3:16. That's the only time in the Bible that sickness is ascribed to God. Weymouth translates that, "I will vomit you up." Why? Because in Laodicea, the church was self-satisfied, indifferent. The idea is that they had one foot in the world and the other foot in the church. They were like pew potatoes, which are similar to couch potatoes. They were dead wood, leaves with no fruit, salt that had lost its savor, do-nothing hitchhikers on the church roll. And there's nothing good said in that letter to the church at Laodicea. Now, enthusiasm for the things of the Lord, or enthusiasm in general, is not one of those miraculous gifts that Jack was talking to us about from 1 Corinthians 14 this morning. It's not a miraculous gift. To be hot, to be awake, to be fervent, to be zealous, is not some elusive butterfly that some in the church catch, but others don't. Fact is that everybody is enthusiastic about the things that they love and are deeply interested in. Even a lazy guy will get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go fishing if he's enthusiastic about that. If he loves fishing, he doesn't care that it's 4 o'clock in the morning and he's only had 2 hours sleep. He's raring to go. Football fans will sit out in the ice and the snow for hours to root their team on to victory. That's the fact. We're all capable of and possessed by enthusiasm for the things that mean a lot to us. And that's what enthusiasm is, passion for what means a lot to you. The story is told of a restaurant that had a menu, and on this menu was a dish called enthusiastic stew. There was no explanation about what enthusiastic stew was. So one of the customers asked the waitress, "Why is it called enthusiastic stew?" She said, "It's called enthusiastic stew because our cook puts everything he's got into it." That's pretty good. I like that. In our homes and in our congregations, if we put everything we've got into it, then the results, I think, would be amazing. Remember, the early church was accused of turning the world upside down. Acts chapter 17, verse 6. They went out into a world of paganism and heathenism, and they were militant against that with the new message of Jesus Christ. If you persecuted them, it didn't change anything except that they scattered like firebrands and more congregations were started in more places just because the church was persecuted. The message of Christ was taken everywhere because of the enthusiasm and the passion of those, that first generation of Christians. Somebody wrote a parody about Pentecost. The idea was, what would have happened on the day of Pentecost if their attitude was like ours sometimes is? This is the way it went. The meeting was called for the first day of the week, but so many things interfered that of the company of 120, only 40 could be present. Peter and his wife had bought a cottage on Lake Galilee and were away from the heat of Jerusalem over the weekend. Bartholomew had company, so he couldn't be there. Philip and his family had been up late the night before, and they overslept. Andrew had a business conference about a new boat. James had to stay home and do the yard because Sunday was his only time off. And the point of the writer was that if the disciples were like our congregations, the church would have never gotten started in the first place. Paul said he would gladly spend and be spent for the Lord's work, 2 Corinthians 12:15. That is what his life was all about. Everything else in Paul's life was superfluous. And the fact is that a person can succeed at almost anything for which they have unlimited enthusiasm, because enthusiasm will inspire them to do the things that are necessary for success. Enthusiasm is a magnet that draws kindred souls to its cause. Enthusiasm pulls us out of the mediocre and the commonplace and builds energy and strength into us. That's what Paul was trying to instill in Timothy, I think, when he said, stir up the gift that is in you. In 2 Timothy 1:6, you know what I'm talking about? Stir up the gift that is in you, Timothy. This gift that is in you came from God through the laying on of my hands, but neither God nor I can use it for you, Timothy. You've got to stir it up. You're the one that's got to use it. We gave it to you. You use it. Like a blacksmith stirring up the coals. And we ought to have this enthusiasm because of the position we're in. We are serving a captain who has never lost a battle. We have a word to guide us that's absolutely perfect and infallible. We have an amazing happiness awaiting us in heaven. No wonder Paul says to work heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men, Colossians 3:23. If you're fervent, if you're on fire, then when somebody throws cold water on you, you just turn that into steam, and it doesn't diminish the energy that you have. I'll never forget, as a sixth grader, reading Herman Melville's long novel, Moby Dick. I didn't know what it was really supposed to be about. I didn't know anything about the symbolism. I just read it as a story because it was on the shelf of our sixth grade classroom for some reason. Anyway, I'll never forget what he said about the hollow men. Guys just sleepwalking through life. I'll never forget Captain Ahab's obsession and how Melville was obsessed with Captain Ahab and his obsession. And I'll never forget what he had Captain Ahab say about people who live life with half a heart and one lung. Half a heart and one lung. If we're not careful, we can be in that very category. Now, I know emotions can be dangerous. Emotions can be deceptive. But they do have their rightful place as God-given elements of our makeup. There's a difference between emotionalism and emotions themselves. Emotion is as much a part of our makeup as our nervous system is or as our brain is. And as dangerous as emotionalism can be, deadness of spirit certainly is not tolerated by the Lord either. There is a God-given, heaven-inspired zeal that's armed with knowledge from God's word and confidence in the Lord. Yes, everything in the church is to be done decently and in order, but it's also to be done fervent in spirit. True worship is in spirit and in truth. So we need that balance. I'm going to conclude by telling you about a fire drill that was done in elementary school. This principal that was leading the school had this fire drill so he could see how long it would take to empty the building in case of emergency. Needed to know that. So he stood at the door until the last person was out and looked at his watch. It had been 4 minutes and 3 seconds to empty the building. He felt pretty good about that. 4 minutes isn't bad, he said. Felt pretty good about it until that same day when the bell rang to dismiss the children and teachers from school, the building was evacuated in only 3 minutes. That's a difference of 63 seconds, and the difference was enthusiasm. They had a reason to get out. when it was time to go home. So you and I in the Lord's family, we don't want to traffic in unfelt truth. Jeremiah had a fire in his bones, and we want to have the same thing. Because enthusiasm builds endurance, which provides a sustaining power for us over time. A cheetah, I'll close with the cheetah. A cheetah can sprint at up to 70 miles an hour, the fastest animal on land alive. But that long, sleek body has a disproportionately small heart. And that causes it to tire quite soon. So if it doesn't succeed almost immediately in its efforts, it has to give up the chase. Have you noticed so often projects in the church start with great energy and zeal, but they lack the sustained enthusiasm and energy over time? It won't work unless there's a heart and a fire within, a magnificent obsession that's more caught than taught. It affects the joy that we have in our day-to-day life in living for the Lord. When Paul came to Athens, his spirit was stirred within him, Acts 17, verse 16. And as much as we can, we need to follow Paul as he followed Christ with that same kind of a spirit. I'm going to leave that message with you today. Thank you, Sherry, for asking about that. And once again, we'll extend the Lord's invitation in closing. Never knowing the hearts of those who are present, we always extend this invitation because we want you to have every opportunity to come to this simple faith in Jesus Christ that Ed was talking about a few moments ago. If you have never been immersed into Christ for the remission of your sins, but yet you believe in Him, you're penitent, you're willing to confess Him, you've never been immersed, this would be the perfect time for you to do that. Let us take you and plunge you beneath the water so that you may rise and walk in newness of life. If you have that or anything else to bring before us today, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front as we stand together and sing the last song.